Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny along with Denise Miller, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM in Moscow, Pullman. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Layton Whitman Recovery Community Centers. You can find them on the web at laytonrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. The Layton Recovery Community Center is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRCC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at laytonrecoverycenter@gmail.com. And their hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Whitman Recovery Community Center is located at 226 East Main Street in Pullman. And you can contact the WRCC by phone at 509-715-1111 or by email at wrccprogrammanager@gmail.com. And their hours in Pullman are 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. Like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And sitting to my right is Miss Denise Miller. Hello, Denise.
Hello, everyone. Glad you could listen in today.
Fantastic. And today, the calendar, you can go online. I think the February calendar should be up and ready to go. If not, it will be in a day or so to check out all the cool things that are coming up. And just a reminder, coming up in March, on March 4th, is going to be our annual fundraising breakfast and dessert. I believe they'll be going from 7 till whenever in the morning, and then I think the evening one starts again at 7.
Yes.
But you can find more information on that at our website, which is laytonrecoverycenter.org, and look for us on Facebook. To find out more about that and how you can be a part of it, I think we might have all our tables filled up, but there's always room for one more. We can sneak in somehow. It's a great deal. I'm not sure who the featured speaker is going to be this year.
It's going to be Megan, the director of the Whitman Recovery Center.
Oh,
Pullman. Yes.
Megan Guido.
Yes, and I'm sure we still have plenty of seats left, and we may need a few more table captains. And also a shout out, if you know me and you want to sit at my table, just give a call to the Layton Recovery community and let them know.
Fantastic. Yeah, you can give us a call, 208-883-1045, or you can email laytonrecoverycenter@gmail.com, and Daryl, our director, will pick that up. And he's really good at returning calls and getting things set up. So yeah, so something to keep in mind. That's a big date, even though it's a month out.
Yeah.
Now's the time to get.
And so it's at the Best Western University Inn, and at 7 a.m. in the morning, there's a breakfast that's catered. It's delicious, and then another opportunity in the evening at 7 p.m. that a dessert. I believe in the past it's been an ice cream bar.
Yeah. Yeah, yep. Do-it-yourself Sunday bar. Yeah.
So you can join us then as well. And so just whatever works out more convenient.
Yeah.
It's really fun. It's very encouraging, and it's a good time.
Yeah, you can even meet Miss Denise will be there, and Radio Johnny will be there.
That's right.
And quite probably our guest today,
who is
Katie. Katie, welcome to Recovery Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's super to have you. Katie, I've known for a couple of years now. Through my program of recovery. And why don't you start out by sharing with us like a little bit of your history, how you got to Moscow, or where you went to school, all that good stuff.
Oh, sure. So I grew up in Priest River, Idaho, which is about 3 hours north of Moscow. And my dad's whole side of the family is up there. And so it was a real small town. Like, I went to high school with people who, my teacher went to school with my grandma.
Okay.
And so it was a real small town. We couldn't get away with anything, me and my brothers, you know, because, you know, we'd go, how did you know we were doing that? And Mom would go, she would never tell us. She would always say God told her. But later we learned it's because, you know, it's just a small town. Everybody would call and say, did you know your kids are over here doing that? And so that's where we grew up. And then my parents started adopting when I was a teenager. And they've adopted 12 children. And then there's three of us biological. And so in 98, they moved to Texas. And in 99, I moved to go with them to take over a children's home. And so we were there 22 years. So all three of my kids were born there. And we always knew that when Mom and Dad retired, we'd end up here in Moscow, because both of my biological brothers live here in Moscow. And so in 2019, that's when we moved back to the area.
Fantastic. Nate? Fantastic. And your I know your recovery story actually kind of starts in Texas, didn't it? So why don't you, we'll roll right into that.
Sure. So I didn't do much drinking as a teenager. It just didn't interest me, and I didn't like the smell of beer, so that was not going to happen. And then I had maybe a couple years, you know, where I drank on and off in my early 20s. And then when I was, you know, 30, 31, I had a crushing relationship that ended, but in just a way that was just soul crushing. It just, you know, ripped my heart out. And so I just kind of went, F it. And that's when I started drinking really heavily. And I've been a smoker most of my life, but, you know, real heavy then. And then I met, you know, kind of the man that was going to be the parent, you know, the father of my two of my children. And that was like fire and gasoline, the two of us together. And I knew that night that he was a cocaine addict, and I just was like, I didn't really care at that moment. And so I did, you know, all of my heavy alcoholic drinking in Texas. Oh, I remember the first time my older son saw me smoking. He was about 6 or 7 years old, and he was yelling at me. He was going, Mom, and crying. He was going, Mom, they told me at school if you smoke a cigarette, you're going to die. And it just didn't affect me. I just brushed it off, and, you know, off I went. And so, you know, I drank for a solid probably 8 years. And it got really, really bad. You know, people didn't trust me. When the kids' dad, when his family met me, they called me a Trixie Bimbo, which I thought was a compliment. I didn't take it as that's a warning sign. And then, you know, they thought I was 100% the problem for their brother, and my family thought that he was 100% of the problem for me, you know. And so it's like it just was really very destructive and not very uplifting. And then so many times I tried drinking differently, because I knew that my drinking was kind of a problem and it was causing issues. Like, you know, I lost a job, not because they fired me, but because I quit before they could fire me, you know. And I had been a social worker, and I had been working with children of prisoners, and you can't really be drinking and, you know, working with children who have parents that are drinking, and, you know, you have to be a good example and things like that. And so I was definitely not trustworthy. I was not able to, you know, be a part of any kind of family events or occasions. Oh, I remember I thought, well, at this family event, I will drink only wine. Because who's ever heard of getting drunk on wine? And those were my...
Besides me?
Right. Famous last thoughts, because right. It turned out pretty poor. And that was at my kids' dad's family's, one of their houses. And I was promptly asked to leave. And I was not welcome there. I wanted really greatly to be a part of and to fit in. And then... with all the drinking, it did lead to blacking out. And I know that I got pulled over probably at least 100 times in Texas, maybe even more. And I thought they were just picking on me. And, you know, it's a funny thing that after I got sober, I've only been pulled over once here in Moscow because I was speeding on 6th Street. But I certainly should have gotten any number of DUIs. I certainly got pulled over a lot of times. I thought my driving was fine, but apparently it caught a lot of attention.
Yeah, when you're up on the sidewalk, you stand out, you know, pretty bad, yeah.
Right, yes. Or if you know, yeah, there's probably a lot of things that I was doing, like weaving and, you know, and then, of course, I usually had my kids with me, and so that was probably an issue, you know. And so there were times when I tried to drink only on the weekends, you know, thinking that I could control my drinking, and that did not last very long, you know. And towards the end of my drinking, it was daily drinking, and then it was drinking first thing in the morning. And so I remember having that bottle right under my bed, you know, between the bed and the wall. And that way I could have that first drink before I even got out of bed, because I had the shake so bad in the mornings. And I still thought that I was managing really well and that I was controlling things and that I didn't have a problem. He had a problem, you know. And so one of the drinking binges that I had at the end that really, you know, helped me change, kind of start to realize that maybe I needed to change, was I woke up from a blackout, and I had no idea where I was at. I was in some strange shed in the backyard of some mobile home in a city I did not remember going to. And I was with this woman, I don't know her name that day or since, and I had never met her before, and there were other people there that I did not know, and I had no idea where my car was. I didn't know how long I'd been there. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just one of those things where it just was very shocking, and that I don't remember it being that dramatic before, where I had woken up like that. And so I had to ride home with this woman and some man to get back to where I was. They dropped me off at my house. I have no idea how my car got home, no idea. And then when I got upstairs, the kids' dad said that I had appeared in the middle of the night with this woman and was demanding money, and he begged me not to leave, and it just, I have no, absolutely no recollection of that at all, except I could tell by the way he was saying it was true. And then, of course, I woke up somewhere strange, you know, and I did end up in the emergency room that time, and I did end up in the emergency room other times as well. My behavior was very risky, and then, you know, so then I really got to the point where I was like, I think this situation is not working out, you know. And I really thought at that time still that if I got away from him, that all the problems would be solved, that I'd be fine and the kids would be fine and all of that. And so I left with the three kids, and I got into a battered women's shelter. And my attitude, you know, was not great, and my drinking continued. In fact, it probably, if it's possible, escalated, and I was not just drinking beer anymore. It was vodka as well, and I was still driving, and I was there at the emergency shelter for a while, and then we switched over to the Transitional Living Center at the YWCA there in El Paso. One of the instrumental people in my recovery and my life is the Boy Scout Master for my oldest son. He and his wife called me one day because I was homeless and in this transitional living center. And so he and his wife offered to give me money. And they didn't say how much or anything. And I was like, well, you know, that's cool. And he said, just to help me get back on my feet and help the kids and all of that. And so I go to take my son to Boy Scouts the next time. And so the Boy Scout master comes out and he walks me to my car. And I figure he's going to hand me money, right? And he doesn't. And he just sends me on my way. And I get in the car and I drive away. And it was years later, probably 4 or 5 years later, that we went on a camp out trip. And we were sitting around the campfire. And I don't know if I asked him or if he just brought it up. And he goes, well, he goes, it takes an alcoholic to know one. And I just looked at him and I said, what do you mean? And he goes, his sober date was June 5th of 1981. And he said that that he knew when he saw my drinking cup. And I'm like, it looks different than other cups. And he goes, I just knew in my spirit the worst thing I could do for you was to give you cash money. You know, that it would not be used to help you get, you know, housing or help with the kids. And he says, I knew in that moment that the one thing I could do the best for you would be to work with your son and get him to Eagle Scout. And he did. Mm-hmm. He did that very, very well. Oh, I took my daughter. She was 5. I took my daughter. I thought she needed counseling. And so I took her to counseling. And the doctor says, well, you know, let's talk to mom first. And so I go into the office, and I don't know what I said, but it must have been, you know, he must have been convinced. But he started talking about how my life had become like, I thought I was living really free and happy in my drinking and in my, you know, my what I thought was control of my own life. But what he said I was doing was living in this box, and it was like a fish tank. So it looks like I have freedom, but this box that I'm living in is getting smaller and smaller because of my drinking and because of my behavior and all those risky things. And then he looked around the room and he goes, you know, I have a book around here somewhere. And he pretended to be looking, and then he pulls out the AA Big Book, and he starts to read to me from it about the allergy to alcohol. And there was just something in him that I could hear it that day. I could hear the message. And I heard that the problem wasn't just my moral character, or that it wasn't just my control. It was something inside of me was different, and that when I ingest any amount of alcohol, one is too many and a million is not enough, that I just cannot stop drinking until I'm sick or I, you know, pass out or black out. And so he suggested that I go to AA meetings. And I said over my dead body. And so I leave and I'm thinking, I'm going to show him. I'm going to stop drinking, and I can do this on my own. And then I was sick for like 2 solid weeks. And just, I had no idea that you could withdraw from alcohol, and I didn't know it was dangerous. And I did end up in the emergency room a couple times. I didn't know to say I was, that I had stopped drinking. I didn't know, you know, to say that. But, you know, they just kept telling me that I was fine, that there was nothing wrong with me. And I was like, no, I'm sure. And then when it finally hit me that that I was not going to be able to stop drinking on my own, I went to the counselor there at the TLC, and I told her, and she says, well, let's try outpatient treatment. So she sent me to Aleviani outpatient treatment there in El Paso, and I went once, and it's like, let's pour out your guts, and then I'll see you in a month. And I was like, this is not going to work, you know. And so I went back to the counselor, and she goes, well, you know, we could send you to inpatient. And I was like, well, I won't leave my kids. And she goes, oh, they can go with you.
Problem solved.
Yep.
Yeah. And so my older son stayed with my parents, and the two little kids, 5 and 1, they went to rehab with me, and I tell them now, you've already done rehab. You don't have to do it again. And
you've been cured. You don't need to have a problem.
That's right.
Ever. Yeah. So it's not allowed.
Yeah. Right, right. And so I had to drive out to my parents' place to drop off my son, and my parents are sitting there on the porch, and I how do you tell your parents that you're an alcoholic and that you're about to go to rehab? And so I'm coming up onto the porch, and I say it really fast. I go, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to rehab. You need to keep my son. And I kept booking it right into the house. And so a few minutes later, I like sheepishly come back out, and my mom goes, please tell me, this is a quote from Steel Magnolias, the movie. She goes, please tell me you only have a brain tumor. And we laughed, and I said, no, I'm really an alcoholic, and I'm going into treatment. And she goes, well, I just never knew that you drank. And she goes, I've never noticed anything different about you, you know. And I said, well, Mom, I said, no one ever in the middle of the night needs money for baby formula, baby food, baby medicine, or baby anything. And she goes, well, honey, you do all the time. I said, exactly. And I said, you don't need to give me money ever again. You know, and I went off to rehab, and it's not one of those spas. I had no health insurance, and so it's one of those freebie, you know, places that's all cement and kind of added on to willy-nilly, and the walls were thin, and they had the transom windows, so everything was noisy and loud night or day, and the lights never went off in the hallways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, They didn't talk about alcohol. They talked about, you know, working on your emotions. And I didn't want to work on my emotions, you know, and things like that. And then on Sunday nights, a volunteer from AA would bring in the meeting into the rehab. And the only reason I went to the AA meeting is they provided childcare. So I'm very thankful for that now, but at the time it got me into the rooms, and this woman just was so bubbly, and she had so much life, and she had this big smile and these really bright colored shoes on, and she just bounced. And so, you know, and then when the meeting started, she got serious and she told us for real and for certain how she was an alcoholic and an addict, and so she, you know, really gained my trust and everything. And then she talked about how she was in recovery, and then she said something ridiculous, like that she was sober like 3,000 days, and I was like, sober 7, and I was like, or 12, or whatever days I was at that moment, you know. And I was like, that's impossible. In my mind, I was like, there is no way anyone can stay sober that many days consecutively, you know. And then at the end of the meeting, she handed out the little AA books. They're brown or red. I think it's red, but other people say it's brown. And she was handing one to each of the ladies. And when she got to me, she said, oh, I don't have any more. And she goes, well, I'll bring you one next time. And I was like, are you sure? You know, is there anything that you have in there? And she goes, well, I do have this one. And she pulled out the little book, but it was missing. The cover had been ripped off. And then the pages were like wavy, like they had been wet and then dried. And I, you know, and she goes, well, I can't give you this one. It's really ugly. And I said, well, it kind of looks like me, like, you know, it's really ugly on the outside, but maybe the message is still in there. You know, maybe there's something good in there that I can still get out of it. And so she gave it to me. And I don't know if it was that night, but I remember reading it in the dark, you know, in that room there at the rehab, and just like going, oh no, this is me on this page. And then I would turn the page and I would relate to something else and go, oh my gosh, this is me too. I think I'm an alcoholic. You know, I just was like, I mean, it wasn't an oh no moment, but it was also an aha moment. Like, as I kept reading, I kept going, oh, you know, this is something that other people go through, and they've written a book about it, you know, and there's some hope, and there's maybe some recovery or something on the other side of it. And then I do remember I did not want to believe in God. I was very angry at God. I did not want to have anything to do with him. And then it started talking about having come up with a conception on your own of what your higher power would look like, something outside of yourself that would give you that power to stay and to be sober and not to drink. And I remember, you know, thinking, oh, you mean I can lay down everything that I think I know about God and everything I've heard from others and from church and all of that, just lay it aside just for a little while, you know, and start to, you know, ask that higher power just to reveal itself to me, you know. And that was like just this, I mean, now I look back on it and go, that was my spiritual awakening. You know, it was really, really neat. And it just was life-changing. You know, from that time on, rehab didn't seem quite so drab, you know. And I did learn a couple of other things at rehab. I saw some really extreme examples of self-will run amok, where one woman said, well, someday they'll make marijuana legal, and therefore, then they'll have to give me my kids back because I'm not giving up marijuana. And I was like, man, I don't want to be like that. You know, I mean, I want to have my kids with me and then and be healthy, you know, and give them a good example. And so they did release me from rehab. And, of course, I did go to AA meetings. I went to a lot of them. The Ilano Club right there in El Paso. I would show up for the 8 a.m. love group and stay for the 9 o'clock and then stay for the 10 o'clock Al-Anon meeting because it was available. And then I would switch over to the Catholic Church for the 12 o'clock. And, you know, and then I would race back out to where my parents lived and I would, you know, drop off my kids so that I could go to work, and then I would get up and go again the next day and do the same thing. But all those meetings, you know, when I first walked down the hallway of the Ilano Club, it just, I was terrified. I didn't think I really needed to be there, you know. And, but you know, that lady that came into the rehab, you know, I mean, I really wanted what she had, you know. And so, and as you come down that hallway, you can hear the laughter and you can hear the camaraderie. And then in those, in that love group, especially, that was my home group. It still is when I'm in El Paso. But, you know, somebody would give out nicknames, you know, and so there was Special Ed and Leo the Lion and Nacho Baracho and all these fun names. And so I wanted one of those nicknames really bad. And then, you know, I didn't really want to, like, necessarily talk to anybody. But after the meeting, you know, they grab a hold of me and they go, we're going to coffee. You have to come. And so I was kind of voluntold that I was going to coffee.
Yeah.
And off I go to coffee. And, you know, and that's what they call the meeting after the meeting,
mm-hmm.
where you get to, you know, really relate to people and see how this program is working in their life after, you know, coming out of that meeting. How do they live when other people are drinking around them or that their job brings them in contact with things like that? And how does that work? Then I worked at the Dollar General. It's the only place I could find a job at, you know, and I just kept thinking, don't they know who I am? You know, I mean, I was a social worker, you know, and so here I am working at the Dollar General, and I hated seeing the customers walk in the door. They were going to mess up my shelves, and I hated my coworkers, and I hated my boss. I hated the building. I hated the parking lot. I didn't want to do this work. I didn't want to clean the bathroom. You know, I mean, on and on and on. And I was going to counseling then, and I would tell the counselor, I'd go, I don't want to say to the customers, welcome to Dollar General. And she'd go, my counselor would, she'd say, that's the true you coming out. And I'm like, no, it's not. You know, but that Dollar General turned into like a college education for me because my higher power really used it as like sandpaper to rub off all the rub edges, or at least a lot of them. I probably still have some. But, you know, while you're stocking the shelves, you can listen to things. And so I would listen to podcasts, and I would listen to sermons, and I would listen to books and music and, you know, all kinds of things in the back of that store. And you know, pretty soon I started to look forward to going to work, and then I was looking forward to the customers, and then I had my favorites and then my regulars, and pretty soon they're coming in and giving me hugs. And then, you know, towards the end, you know, it's really neat when someone comes in a really bad mood, and from the time that they come to the register to the time they walk to the door is only, you know, 15, 30 seconds. But if you, you know, it almost became a challenge, like, can I take this grumpy person in front of me and make them laugh before they leave the door? And that was, you know, it actually became probably my favorite job. You know, where I really got to know people and you know, learned a lot and yeah, just I guess started to learn how to relate to others. You know, meanwhile, I'm still going to all these AA meetings. And then I remember one time my oldest son came by the store because if they wanted to see me, I worked a terrible shift from 3 to 11. So if they wanted to see me after school, they had to come see me at work. And so he comes and he's standing next to me and he's telling me all the bad things that I did while I was drinking. You know, and I'd been sober probably 5 years by then. And he was telling me all the bad things that the kid's dad had done to him and the situation. And I just listened and I didn't deflect anything and I didn't make any excuses. And I said, yeah, that really stinks, you know. And the best thing I can do to make up for it is that it doesn't happen today. It doesn't happen anymore. And then I told him, I said, you know, now from today on, now that you've told me and we've, you know, talked about this, I go, now it's up to you. What are you going to do with your life? You know, are you going to use this anger that you're feeling right now? Are you going to use it to spur you on for good? Or are you going to let it spur you on to go towards the bad? And I tell that story because it was really hard for me to hear the things that he had to say to me. But I'm so glad that he did. And, you know, he's done so well in his life, you know, really, really well. And I'm, despite all the things that I did, you know, he turned out really, really neat. And then, you know, when I got to the emergency shelter, of course, CPS was involved and, there was a restraining order against the kids' dad, you know, between myself and him. And, when I got sober, you know, maybe a year and a half in, I did reach out to him, and I really wanted him to get sober. I really wanted him to feel that freedom and then be able to be with the kids and I. And I was hoping, you know, that there'd be this, like, you know, happy family, happy ending type of a thing. And, you know, I worked with him for a long time, you know, really asking him to, and he never got it. And he went to NA meetings, and he went to rehabs voluntarily, but mostly court-ordered, and jail several times. But he didn't get sober then. It wasn't until, you know, I waited about 7 years there in El Paso, and then the kids and I moved to Moscow here, and then their dad got a little bit more motivated because I was, you know, completely out of the state. But it wasn't until 24 that 23 that he called and said, he called and left a message at my work, and it took me about a week to work up the courage to call him back. And then when I did, he called to say that, you know, that he was sick, that he had cancer, and he said that he was sober, that he had actually gotten sober maybe about 9 months or about 3 months before he'd gotten diagnosed, but about 9 months before when we were talking right then. And he said, don't come to El Paso, you know. He goes, save the money. And so I hung up with him, and I called his sister to make sure that the story was true, because, you know, he had tried other ways to get me to come back, you know, and things that weren't true. And then the kids and I hopped a plane, and we flew to El Paso. And the next day, I shakingly called him, and you know, I told him that we were there in El Paso, and he says, I told you not to come. And I said, I've never listened to you before. Why would I start now? And I just told him, I said, you know, our kids need to see you when you're sober, and they need to see you when you're not angry. They think you were angry at them. They think that they did something wrong that made you use or made you, you know, not want to be with us. And so, you know, I said, your son wants to know how tall he's going to be. You know, and they need to know that all the stories I've told them about you are true. You know, the things about his childhood and things like that. And so we went out and met with him. And yeah, it was a beautiful reunion where, you know, you're nervous. Everybody's, you know, getting, just seeing each other after several years. But it was really great. And the kids kind of started going, well, wait a minute. If that story is true, then all the stories Mom tells us is true about you. And that was really neat. And then it was right after COVID was still a big thing down in El Paso. And so his family got upset that I was there with the kids and that maybe I'd bring COVID to their family. So they said, you can't be around him. And then he was really sick. So he moved to a motel and we moved to the same motel. And we spent every day for a whole week in the lobby there. And, you know, the kids, you know, especially my son, got to play Legos and chess and, you know, do all those things with his dad. And their dad said, he goes, it's because of cancer that, you know, I really had that spiritual awakening. And he goes, I'm free. I'm free of the addiction, free of the, you know, all that angst that's inside. And, it just was a full circle and it was really, really neat. And then we video called every night until he wasn't able to take calls anymore. And then his brother did, you know, and then, he died in September of 2023. And a year later, when the kids and I went to El Paso for a visit, his family, who couldn't trust me for 5 minutes years earlier when I was sober, they let us stay in their father's house by ourselves for a whole week. It was just like a coming, like complete circle, you know, like I went from being an untrustworthy Trixie bimbo to being, you know,
a mother part of the third grandchildren, yeah.
Yeah, and part of their family, and that was really neat, and I'm really happy that the kids get to see that. You know, their dad had a life before addiction, and that he wasn't always angry and addicted, that he had gone to college, and he'd you know, had a career and all of those things, and so they have that connection with him still through their family. Then I was here in here in Moscow, living and working. And in the spring of 22, I started recovery in a different program, not just AA, but also Overeaters Anonymous. And I knew I had a problem with food, that when I stopped drinking, I pretty much switched over to the food. And so I started going to Overeaters Anonymous. We have a face-to-face meeting on Monday nights in Pullman, 7 o'clock at the Church of Christ. And I started work, you know, getting a sponsor in that program and working the steps. And in the spring of 2023, we worked the steps together as a group. And that was really good because I had just worked the fourth step and was willing to make amends and all of those things that you do in the steps. And that's when their dad called. And I really truly believe that if I hadn't just done that with that other group, I wouldn't have been ready and healthy enough to go, you know, work on that relationship with him. And then, but it wasn't until the very end of 2023 that the food, you know, came to a head again where in November I had taken a trip and I thought, well, while I'm on my trip for this weekend, I can get off this food plan I had been on for several months. And I thought, well, I can take a break from it. And when I get back on Monday, don't all diets start on Monday?
Yeah, right.
And so I thought I could go and come back and do that. So that was like November 7th, okay? Well, by December 29th, I was compulsively overeating so badly that I had gained back probably 40 or 45 pounds by then. And I was just completely surrendered. I had given up. I was just there in my kitchen, and you know, I was crying out to my higher power, and I was saying, "I need you to either take the desire for the food, or the desire to diet. You know, one or the other. And the results are none of my business." Is pretty much what I said, and that's what it took. And from January 1st, really, of 24, I have lost 100 pounds since then. And it feels really good. And it wasn't just the weight that came off, you know, and they call it releasing the pounds in Overeaters Anonymous. But it was the emotional baggage that I thought I had taken care of in AA, but apparently not. You know, I had to do, you know, work the steps in another program. But and it just really, it just feels so different. It was like I had this big, heavy winter jacket on, and I've taken it off, and I don't need that protection that, you know, food obviously was the solution for a while, you know, and now I don't need that solution anymore. I've found a much healthier, better solution in the 12-step programs.
Wow, that's, you know, that's pretty spectacular. I find that people that do the other 12-step programs, you know, like NA and Sexaholics Anonymous, CODA, Codependent Anonymous, Celebrate Recovery, they're all really addressing the same thing, which is some sort of spiritual, what we call in AA, a spiritual malady.
Yes.
You know, but sometimes you just need to focus in on something in particular. You know, there are people, there are so many people that come into AA who are what I would call dual addicted. You know, they're use substances as well as alcohol. And some of the old timers in the program would like, oh, well, you're not really an alcoholic, you're a dope fiend or whatever. It stems from the same spiritual malady. And I've seen people who were drug addicts or substance abusers, abandon like NA to go to AA because they feel like they have a better, you know, chance at recovery. Because like I said, you know, we're treating a spiritual malady. I can see how, you know, getting specific though with like food, yes, which is, you know, a different way of getting dopamine hits. If you're, yes, having problems with it, yeah, getting specific on it is probably a good idea.
Yes. Yeah. And now, so now I feel like it takes a whole village to keep, mm-hmm, Katie sober and off the food, because I have an AA sponsor and I have an OA step sponsor, mm-hmm, and then I have an OA food sponsor, and then I have all the fellows that are in the rooms of AA and OA.
Right.
And yeah, it takes all of them to make me this happy, joyous, and free.
Well, there you go. And that's what we're shooting for. And speaking of free, we're almost free of time for today. That was magnificent. Any time where I can't talk or am not needed to talk is a good interview as far as I'm concerned.
It really is. Good share. Thank you for just sharing so much of your testimony. It was awesome to listen to.
Yeah.
Thank you for captivating.
It is a lot. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, especially, you know, talking about, you know, family. You know, it's one thing for me to get sober, but to you know, be aware and cognizant of the things, the damage that the family suffers through it. And wow, how brave of your son to come yes. and share that with you. Yeah. You know, that's also a testimony to your sobriety, though, because he obviously knew that it was okay to talk about it now.
Yes.
You know, I never had that conversation with my parents. You know, I never did. I just like, that's the way they are. You know, I'm doing my own thing. I don't care. And that's, you know, that's water under the bridge for me, though, because they're both gone. And that's, I'll move on.
Right. Yes.
So I want to say thank you again, Katie, for coming in and spending this time with us. That's fantastic, and sharing your story, like you said. And thank you, Denise, for sitting
here. Glad to
be
here. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it was a good time. And I'll close it off with the usual. You know, if you think you have a problem with alcohol or other substances, you do. And maybe you should stop by the LRC or the WRC and talk to one of our happy, helpful, peer recovery specialists and our recovery coaches like Miss Denise or Sean or any one of a bunch of others, and see what you can do about it. You gotta have some actions. So have a great day. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.
Got out of town. Boat going to Southern Islands, sailing to reach before a following sea. She was making for the trades on the outside and the downhill run to Papeete. Off the wind on this heading lie the Marquesas. You got 80 feet waterline, nicely making way in a noisy bar in Avalon. I tried to call you, but on a midnight watch I realized why twice you ran away. Think about
how many times I have fallen. Spirits are using me, larger voices call. Southern Cross for the first time, you understand now why you came this way. Cause the truth you might be running from is so small, but it's as big as the promise of a coming day. So I'm sailing for tomorrow, my dreams are a-dying, and my love is an anchor tied to you,
tied with a silver chain.
I have my ship and all her flags are a-flying. She is all that I have left,
and music is her name.
Think about
how many times I have fallen. Spirits are using me, larger voices.
God, okay.
tested, and we never failed to fail. It was the easiest thing to do. You will survive being bested. Somebody fine will come along, make me forget about loving you. In the Southern Cross,